Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I am he, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste. And today, I'm particularly excited because we're not just talking about taste today with random people who think about food, but we're talking with taste about taste with one of the most influential tastemakers in the country, Pete Wells, the restaurant critic for the New York Times. Good morning, Pete.
Hi, Mitchell.
How are you?
I'm fine, although I want to assure you that I am kind of random.
Well, your position is one of the most important taste-making positions, let's say, and you are in it now, and you are, you know, your opinions matter.
Oh, well, good. That's good.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we'll talk about that, because you aren't as random as some might think, but tell me, before we get into it, do you eat breakfast? What'd you have today?
I almost every day I have... if this starts to get too intimate and revealing, just stop me. But almost
no such
every day
thing.
I
this
have
is the internet radio.
A bowl of oatmeal, which I hope will kind of undo a lot of the damage that I do to my circulatory system. But this morning I was over on Smith Street and sort of found myself magnetically drawn into Bianquit, and they had this little, they were calling it a Sicilian breakfast pizza or something. It was like a little bit of lightly cooked tomato on like Danish pastry, on a square of Danish pastry, and it was just very, very lightly sweet and kind of great, but I don't think it helped with the larger struggle against cholesterol.
Well, my mouth is watering thinking about it, and Ashley, our associate producer, is laughing because she thinks that I'm paid by Bianqui. I recommend it so often. I'm glad to hear that you enjoy it too. Fun. I just love that place. So let's talk about what you do for a living these days. After a long career writing about food, editing the food section of the Times, in fact, you are now paid to eat out and tell people what you think. Kind of weird,
yeah.
Huh?
So it is a little strange. It's kind of amazing that this job exists and that it hasn't been, you know, completely made obsolete by all of the other voices in food that are out there now. So I feel pretty lucky that Times still, you know, thinks it's worth funding.
And why do you think that is? Why hasn't it been as affected by some of the changes in media that have decimated so many other positions?
Well, it has been affected, I think. I mean, I think, you know, you have to approach the reviews a little differently from, you know, how one might have done it 20 years ago when you know, the Times critic and Gail Green and maybe a couple of other voices were pretty much it, you know. And, you do have to take it into account somehow.
Take what? The other people? The chatter elsewhere?
The fact that you know, there are just so many more opinions out there now and so many other places people can turn for opinions. And you know, there's certainly more skepticism about, you know, what the Times can bring to the table if you can go to... you know, your favorite food discussion board with, you know, 10 different voices dissecting a restaurant and sort of the, you know, the value that you can get from, you know, a bunch of smart people weighing in on the subject and bringing their own perspectives, and sort of the, you know, the hive mind can work mm-hmm. really, really well. And then you have Yelp, where I don't know if it's exactly at the same level, but I scan Yelp a lot, and I think I learn something about restaurants. You have to kind of put it through a Yelp decoder, I think. But
I don't have that app yet, but I'll look forward to it.
Yeah. You have to build it yourself, and it keeps crashing every few minutes.
So, I mean, let's start with the brass tacks. How do you in this environment, in a city where every time I pick up Time Out, for instance, there are 10 restaurants I've never even heard of, let alone been to. How do you choose a restaurant to go to? What's your process, just logistically, in doing the job, approaching the job?
Well, the main thing is to eat out a lot, a lot. I mean, I explain this to people sometimes because it's not obvious, but the Times Critic is supposed to eat at a restaurant under review a minimum of 3 times if it's a starred review. We have other kind of more casual ways of writing about restaurants, but if it's going into the star system, the tradition has been forever that we go at least 3 times and sometimes more. So if you think about the math of that for a minute, I write one review a week, one starred review a week, and each one of those reflects 3 meals. So that means basically if you leave out lunches, which don't always work that well, I'm out 3 nights a week minimum. And then, if some great assignment editor were just handing me each week's review and saying, here, go write about this restaurant, then I could get away with just going out 3 nights a week. But part of the opportunity and challenge of the column is to, decide what I want to review, what I think is interesting, what I think people will want to know about, and that requires a lot of scouting and some, kissing of frogs before you find the prince that you want to tell people about. One of my goals is to find places that people will be excited to be told about, to find the good food. And you don't always know until you try it. There's an awful lot of hype. As anybody who follows this world knows, there's a lot of hype about new restaurants out there. And some of it's deserved and some of it's less deserved. And then there are places that don't get hyped at all that ought to be. And those are the real challenges, the places that for some reason or other are not on the radar, but they really should be.
Mm-hmm. And you said you're looking for places that have good food. How much are you looking for also places that can be a good story? What part of the, I mean, especially now with so much opinion about restaurants available to people looking to choose a place to eat, and I imagine an ever-growing global readership of the Times because of the internet, do you take that into account with a story that you can actually tell? I mean, you're such a writerly food person.
I do, although I think I also just assume that if I think the place is worth writing about, I'll figure out what the story is, that it will just come. There are some places, that you just kind of need to do, and some places that are kind of irresistible, and other places where, I don't really know going into it if there is a story at all, but hopefully by the end of 3 meals, I've kind of figured out what it is that the restaurant's all about, what the chef is trying to communicate, and I can pull some kind of narrative about that, but it changes every week, some weeks it's pretty straightforward, and it's just, go eat here, you're going to like it. Another week, it's a little more complicated. You have to work a bit harder to hold people's interest. I mean, one example is sushi. Where if you just describe every single piece of sushi placed before you as if you were describing a plate of pasta, it would get kind of tired pretty quickly. The fish was raw. The rice was white. those are places where you have a little more work to do to construct a narrative that will make the food come to life in a way there wouldn't if you just went at it straight on.
Right. So a minimum of 3 times for a restaurant that's going to be in the star system, and I imagine you bring people with you. Do you listen to them, or do you just want them there so that when you order an amazing amount of food, you don't look conspicuous?
It's a little of both. Part of it is they're definitely there. They're definitely there to let me fill up the table with stuff that I need to sample. But I do listen to people, and I watch them and see how they're responding to the restaurant. Do they feel comfortable? Are they having a good time? Sometimes people will dislike something that I think is good, and sometimes, you know, people I eat with will like something that I think is not so good. And at times like that, you do have to go with your own gut, because you're the one that's being paid and your name is on the review.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got a fair number of dining companions who are pretty perceptive and say smart things about food, and I love having them along. It can be really helpful. It helps me to think, to hear how other people respond.
Interesting.
And also, I use them sometimes as decoys. From time to time, when I need to take a restaurant by surprise, and I'm pretty sure they know what I look like, I'll send my friends in advance and see how they're treated and what kind of table we get, and then I'll be the latecomer, seated last.
Right. Do you have a bag of tricks, so to speak, like that, and for other things that you need to do to maintain anonymity, or to also just to test the restaurant, say, or I don't know. Are you looking, besides being the average diner, are you looking to put them through any hoops?
Boy, that's an interesting question. You try to test some. You try to gauge the hospitality, the fact is, if they see me walking in the door, they'll probably give me the person they consider the best server in the house, and they won't let my table out of their sight for a minute. So there are other ways to try to gauge that. And you can watch other tables and see how they're treated. To be honest, sometimes I'm recognized and sometimes I'm not, and the experience can change a lot.
Right, for the better and for the worse, I would imagine.
Yeah, both. It's funny. Sometimes it is worse. I mean, it's certainly I'm very used to having a very full glass of water when I go out to eat. I very rarely find that I'm sitting in front of an empty glass.
Well, my grandmother would want to eat with you.
Somebody magically notices that I just took a sip and the glass is refilled. So I'm pretty used to that, but people I go out with are driven crazy by it. There's always somebody hovering, trying to show that they're, boy, we really pay attention to our customers at this place.
Oh, funny.
And you don't necessarily want somebody standing over your table all the time if you're trying to have a conversation and enjoy the meal. So that's a way which it can definitely make the experience a little bit worse. Although I try to tune it out. I'm getting used to it now.
Sure. I'll remind our listeners that you can call and ask Pete questions about reviewing, even about restaurants, I presume, ones he's been to and written about, likely not ones he hasn't, at 718-497-2128. You can also write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or if you're listening to the podcast, or if you just prefer to write 140-character sentences, you can tweet us at TasteMattersHRN. So this whole idea of anonymity, I think, is a fascinating one, because as you said, often you're recognized and the experience changes, and it's one that's in some ways unique to the way that we do reviews here in the U.S., and I think the role that the critic plays vis-a-vis some other places. England comes to mind, where not only are the critics known, they're big celebrities and they mouth off a lot. And are, what do you think about that? Do you think there's something to be gained? Obviously, I guess you do, but from the anonymity, that's different from another type of criticism, say theater criticism, where everyone knows the critics in the house?
Yeah, well, you know, if you're reviewing a play and everybody knows that the first few rows are full of critics, of course the actors will be, you know, extra super nervous and very much aware of it. But I don't think the experience can change quite as dramatically as when a restaurant critic is at the table. That's a case where they really can do a lot, from giving you, you know, a bigger piece of meat, or mm-hmm. you know, just you know, making sure your table gets taken care of before anybody else. So I think that, you know, I think of anonymity as a sort of unachievable ideal. Mm-hmm. You know, I try, I do my best. I certainly try to take them by surprise at the door, at least, if nothing else. That I try not to let on that I'm going to be in the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that works, and sometimes I'm pretty sure it hasn't worked, but I do make the effort, and then you know, once I'm there, there's not that much I can do about it. And you know, and if restaurants are looking for me, they're going to see me. If they're not looking for me, they may not see me immediately.
Well, and that's a good segue to mention that that's why you're calling in, because we're sitting here in a shipping container with a giant window onto the dining room of Roberta's, where a couple has just sat down right in front of me, and I'm talking to an empty chair. And I will continue that conversation, a different empty chair from the Obama empty chair.
Right.
But we'll be right back after a short break. You're listening to Taste Matters.
So what you wanna do? I'm standing right in front of you. Like a broken tool. Just tell me what's your name, where you come from, where you go away.
You're listening to Summer Jam by Cookies on heritageradionetwork.org.
And I'll worship you like gold. I'll do just as I'm told. I'll worship you like gold. Oh, oh, oh. Like a kid in his favorite song. This night goes on and on.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking to restaurant critic of the New York Times, Pete Wells. So you're a James Beard Award-winning food writer. You have written about wine for magazines. You were the editor of the Times and did some great reporting while you were there, of the Times food section, I should say. Have there been surprises about this role that you probably had aspired to that you didn't expect?
Well, you know, it's funny. I didn't really particularly aspire to it. I never thought it was I never thought it was the most interesting way to write about food. You mm-hmm. know, I think I have always enjoyed writing reported features and having voices and interviews and characters and a story to tell and something, you know, something new to tell people. And I think I've always thought what the restaurant critic did is more limited, just mm-hmm. from the point of view of what it offers you as a writer. You know, you sit there and you're a little bit passive. You have these meals and then you reconstruct them. You're not in the kitchen with a chef.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly that's just off the table, so to speak. You are missing a lot of the things that could make a reported piece really fun and lively. But on the other hand, you get to have a voice, and you get to toss your opinions around more than you do with a reported piece. I guess the first surprise is how interesting it is for a writer to explore stuff that I thought was limited. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. It turns out to be not that limited at all, and kind of a great spur to thinking creatively about different ways to tackle this somewhat formulaic genre.
We have a call, actually, a question from a listener, and that caller is there.
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Who are you?
How are you?
Good. Who are you?
Who am I?
What's your name?
Frank from Manhattan.
Hi, Frank. What's your question?
How are you?
Good.
So I've been an avid reader of the New York Times Restaurant Review for years. I've always been curious if, in the halls of the Times, you guys ever discussed creating a rubric or a system on which you grade or critique restaurants. It seems that there's no denying that a restaurant is about many, many factors. Obviously, food is very important, as well as service. But there's things like beverage programs and beer programs and cocktail programs and hospitality at the front door and on the phone and all kinds of things. And it just seems that sometimes reviews are 900 words about how beautiful the place is and 100 words about the bathroom, and very little is written about things like hospitality or service. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, if you guys are providing information for your readership, why they wouldn't consider creating more of a system on which to analyze restaurants.
Good question. Thanks, Frank. Pete?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think week to week in any given review, some aspect of the restaurant is going to get shortchanged. And there are weeks when I say nothing about the decor, and weeks when I have more to say about it. There are weeks when I say nothing about the service, because really there's nothing to say except they brought me the food while it was still hot, and they took it away when the plate was empty, you know, and they didn't do too much more than that. And it doesn't really seem like very interesting information. And there are other times when the service almost approaches the level of ballet, and I try to write about that. I think, Frank, that I'm not sure a system is really the way to address this. I think the thing is to use your instincts and your sense of what's interesting when you've come away from your three meals there, and what does this restaurant really excel at? What do they struggle with? And focus on that. And then I leave a lot of other things on the side. There are weeks when the body of the review says nothing about the wine or the cocktails, the beverage program, and I just deal with it in a line or two in the little box at the end where we break down the addresses and the hours and stuff. And there are other weeks when I go on about that because I think it's interesting and they're doing something different. So, the only system I have is simply trying to keep the focus on what's noteworthy about this particular place. And if you try to systematize these things too much, you're not writing anymore. You know, you're just filling in blanks. And I think the reviews would suffer.
And certainly these days you have, in your position today, there is more opportunity to get more information out there. I mean, there are blog posts that I've seen that you do. There are little podcasty things where you explain more about the food. So in some ways you can make them much more robust than, when Craig Claiborne started, his first reviews were 50 words and he gave the stars and he was the only voice. So they had an incredible impact.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess also part of the reason why I'm asking is because there's no question that the demographic of the New York Times is very far and wide. And there's many people out there who want to hear about wine, or there's many people out there who, might not, think something is as noteworthy, and you do. And in terms of providing for your wide audience of the New York Times, is why I was really, you know, part of the reason why I was asking this question.
Thanks.
Yeah, no,
that's
no,
a good question.
I understand, I try to keep that in mind. Of mean, of course, you don't know who's reading, but you know there are lots and lots of different kinds of people reading. I mean, I know I have a lot of readers in the trade. A lot of people who work in the restaurant industry read that review faithfully, and then there are a lot of people who just like to go out to eat every night or a couple times a week who read it, and then there are people who never go out to eat who read it just for the fun of it, for some you know, vicarious thrills and to keep up to date on the scene. I've got friends who almost never come to New York City who read the review and write to me about it, and I think it's fascinating that people can get that kind of pleasure when there's no prospect of immediate payoff by actually going to the restaurant.
Sure. And in fact, I think when you look at the numbers, one of the funny things I think about the role of critic at the Times in New York City is that in most places, the critic is the person who eats out more than anyone else in town. But here, everyone eats out all the time.
I probably
eat out fewer times than others.
And it's one of the things that I think that the rise of online food writing and the discussion boards in particular and some of the blogs also have made really, really clear is that there's always somebody who knows more than you do.
Right.
You know, there's always somebody who knows, you know, French food better, has been to Paris more recently. There's always somebody who can go on at great length about Uyghur cuisine, which is not my strong suit. You know, there are people out there, and they now have a way to you know, be heard, and it's kind of great, and it's humbling, and just, you know, I try to keep on my toes.
But I will say one thing you also learn from all of that, those other opinions, is that many more people have opinions about food and can express them, but many fewer express them well. I mean, you happen to be a great writer, and, you know, as the journalists who came before you in that position have, and you see, like, how hard one has to work when you read all the other reviews of opinions of people writing off about what they ate and all the things, and in comparison, I mean, you can't compare them. Not that there aren't some great bloggers and Yelpers, I presume, out there, but to just write about what you ate and what you think is not enough. It ain't interesting, even if it was delicious.
Yeah, I mean, it can be interesting in a kind of narrow way of, you know, if somebody describes a meal in great detail, and you might use that as an ordering guide if you go to the restaurant yourself. But the time certainly in recent history, and even not so recent history, has always emphasized the writing. People focus on the star system because the star system is fun and it's interesting, and there's this sense of danger. Will somebody lose their stars? And there's a sense of drama when somebody gets extra stars.
And there's a real impact to the business.
Thrilling, but really, like, we are not the Michelin Guide. You know, the job of the restaurant critic of the Times is not to go around town handing out or taking away stars. The job is to write, and the job is to write a column that's interesting, that will speak to people, maybe say something about the restaurant scene, and maybe say something about New York City, to describe and define a restaurant and its ambitions and how it succeeds or fails. That is the heart of the job, putting it down in words, and the stars are almost, to me, like a punctuation point at the end of the review.
Right, unless you're a restaurant, and then they have an impact.
Because
we don't have a Michelin in the same. Well, we do have Michelin, but it doesn't have the same impact. Although it has an impact, but
it certainly does.
Yeah.
It does in New York, very much so, and I think growing all the time.
So I was looking at an infographic that the Daily Meal and the New York Observer published. Actually, there were a bunch of them, and they seem to think you were handing out stars left and right in your first 6 months compared to one of your predecessors, Frank Bruni and Sam Sifton. Do you think you're more optimistic about food, that you like food better than they?
Well, I'll say I'm always hesitant to talk too much about the you know, my personal, you know, take on this on
sure.
the star system, because you don't want to really put something on the record that because it's not a cut and dried thing.
Look at Mitt Romney.
There's a fair amount of there's an awful lot of subjectivity and a fair amount of just you feel it or you don't feel it, you know it or you don't know it. But one thing I'll say is that I said earlier that I try to write about restaurants that people will want to hear about and people will be excited about. And to me, that means good restaurants. So I look for them, and that's why I'm out more than three nights a week. Mm-hmm. Because I am looking for restaurants that I can have a fair amount of enthusiasm about. And if I'm rating restaurants more favorably, I think part of the reason is because I'm looking for restaurants that I can be more favorable about. You can't really compare what I did to what my predecessors did in that way, because we're not reviewing the same set of restaurants.
Right, of course not. Well, we're going to take an extra couple of minutes. I hope you have the time, because this is internet radio and we can, because I really wanted to talk to you, even though it's 11:30, but I wanted to get to today's reviews and some other writing that you did, because I think it's a really interesting moment where you reviewed Le Cirque today, a great historic restaurant in the New York canon of restaurants, and also you wrote about 11 Madison Park and their new restaurant concept, or their new menu philosophy, and I think they're really interesting juxtaposition. According to what I read from you this morning, one that's an old restaurant that seems to have given up trying very hard, and another that's a new one that's maybe trying too hard. What do you think the juxtaposition of those two say about restaurants today in New York? I mean, based on your eating and your thinking about food.
It's a somewhat accidental juxtaposition, just kind of based on, when the pieces were ready to be written. I certainly didn't mean to have, two somewhat negative pieces in the same issue of the dining section. It just worked out that way. But what does it mean? I think you've got, Le Cirque is in many ways, as you said, a classic, and it's very much the old school of New York dining, which is to say that it's about the restaurateur and the host, and it always has been, the with a few exceptions in its history. The reason to go there has been Cirio Maccioni and his family and the kind of ethic that he's imparted to his staff. And it goes back to, to the days of, the Pavillon and Henri Soulet, who was more famous than any chef who ever worked in that kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the reason people went. Now, of course, there's been a sea change in why we go to restaurants, and almost everybody follows chefs now more than they follow restaurateurs, or the chef is the restaurateur. You know that you're in a Mario Batali restaurant, even if Mario Batali is not the chef.
And we've even gone one farther, where now you're looking at the chef at a counter with 10 other people who were fortunate enough to get in because they knew somebody. And there isn't even a restaurateur or manager within eyeshot.
That's right. And all of that front of house stuff that the host, the saloon keeper, the maitre d' would provide is almost irrelevant. It's been stripped away, and it's just you and the plate in front of you and some cooks across the counter, and the food is absolutely front and center. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, I think, Le Cirque is either trying to deal with that or not trying to deal with that, I think the current state of affairs of that restaurant doesn't necessarily mean too much, because it wasn't that long ago that Frank Bruni gave them 3 stars and thought the cuisine was excellent, I wouldn't be at all surprised if it becomes excellent again in the future. But it will still be Cirio's restaurant, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and that's what we're dealing with. Where 11 Madison Park is very much a new model. Among other things, they've just eliminated the old sort of, I guess you could call it an a la carte menu. Mm-hmm. It was a I think it was four courses that you chose and some others that that just came out. But it was resembled a normal meal, and, mm-hmm. and now it's a very, very long, elaborate meal with many, many courses, and it lasts more or less 4 hours.
And a lot of talking.
And there's a lot of talking, and it's expensive. So it's so, you know, and this is in some ways the way kind of global cuisine is going. For there's now a almost a global circuit of destination restaurants, mm-hmm. and many, many, many of them want to have the same format, which is a long tasting menu, a lot of money. Try to eliminate some seats from the restaurant if you can get away with it, and just pack the place with people who may come from across town or may come from across the world, and the people who come from across the world may be having 50 meals in a similar format in a year.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that stuck in my mind from a conversation I had with René Redzepi, who is the chef of Noma in Copenhagen, for those of you who don't know, and who has been rated the number one restaurant in the world by the World's 50 Best Restaurants, which I have a part in. But one of the most interesting things that he said to me when I asked what the change had been that first year that he became number one, he said, well, now I can cook what I want to, and I don't have, and not what other people want me to cook. So he can, so basically, I mean, emphasizing what you said, it suddenly the experience has become about the chef and not about the hospitality necessarily. Not to say that Noma doesn't treat you very well and give you a great experience, but I thought that was a very interesting and very different way of viewing what a restaurant was.
It is interesting, although I think, you don't necessarily have to become Noma to get away with that. If you think about a restaurant like Prune, mm-hmm. I think what set that place apart from the beginning was that Gabrielle Hamilton said, I'm going to serve what I want to serve, and I want to serve merguez, and I want to serve sardines, and I want to serve octopus and tongue on the same plate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like it, it's a small restaurant, and we hope we can fill the seats with people who do like it. And that to me is one of the hallmarks of a place with a strong point of view. They
mm-hmm.
they serve what they want to serve, and what they think people will enjoy eating. But they don't try to pander by putting out stuff they don't believe in. And you can tell, you can just tell when a restaurant believes in what they're doing and when they believe in a dish. And when a dish comes out that is just there to fill a hole on the menu, you can tell that too.
Right. But there was a time when you probably could have entered the dining room at Le Cirque, say 20 years ago, and no one was eating anything that was on the menu because people treated it like a cruise ship, that you could just go and get whatever you want. And, it's just it's a very different model of
absolutely, that was one of the points of the restaurant, and at some points in the history you had Danielle Ballou in the kitchen, and I'm sure he was getting orders for scrambled eggs at 8 o'clock on a Friday night
and had to be served with a smile. Yes, exactly. Anyway, well, it's been really great to talk to you. I'm so look forward to Wednesdays to see what you have to say and how you say it. I think New York restaurants are better for you in the job, as better for the New York Times maintaining its support of a restaurant critic with a good dining budget, because I think that you really help set the conversation about restaurants. And as those of you who've listened to the show know, I think talking about taste and food and restaurants is part of the process of making them important and good. And I can't thank you enough for talking with us today, Pete.
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. And thanks for having me. It's been really fun. And anytime you want to talk again, just call me up.
Okay, we will. Next week, we're actually taking a new direction for a show. It's Yom Kippur, which is ironic that we'll have a show about food, and we decided to make it a family show since I have cousins and relatives who have had important restaurants at different times in New York, and we're going to talk about the role of family and tradition and food and taste with Madeline Poli, the former chef and owner of the Soho Charcuterie in the 80s, a very popular restaurant, and the creator of New York Burger Company in the aughts. Anyway, you're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. If you listen to a podcast, tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. And in the meantime, before next Wednesday, eat something delicious and talk about it.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.